This is the takeaway for Friday, February 17th, 2017.
This is the takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Welcome to the program. Thanks so much for listening. I want to welcome Mark Lowenthal, former Assistant Director of Central Intelligence for Analysis and Production, to the program. He's current president of the Intelligence and Security Academy. If I gave you a nickel for every time you'd heard a president say he's going to stop leaks coming out of the White House, how rich do you think you would be, Mark?
I would have retired a long time ago.
Exactly. So here we go again. And let's just sketch out what seems to be happening in the first days of the Trump administration. Donald Trump has promised to build a wall between the U.S. and Mexico, restart the coal industry when global demand is down. His determination to eliminate leaks or prosecute leaks is maybe the lowest percentage shot here that he's tried to propose, because it's caused a growing unease within the intelligence community, both nationally and abroad, over the administration's distrust of institutions the president needs to rely on for national security advice. After blasting the criminality of the leaks that former National Security Advisor General Mike Flynn had to resign over for not being forthcoming about talks he had with Russia, President Trump vowed to get to the source of those leaks at a news conference on Thursday. I'm sure you heard this, Mark.
I've gone to all of the folks in charge of the various agencies, and I've actually called the Justice Department to look into the leaks. Those are criminal leaks. They're put out by people either in agencies. I think you'll see it stopping, because now we have our people in.
I think you'll see it stopping. We can revisit that proposition and prediction again. President Trump also expressed disdain for an article published by the Wall Street Journal earlier this week. He blasted it, claiming that some U.S. spies are so wary of Trump that they are withholding information from him. A spokesperson from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence denied those claims. Complicated and turbulent start between the White House and the intelligence agencies this early in the new administration. And Mark, this one is my favorite, underscored by the news last night that Trump's top pick to replace Flynn as National Security Advisor, one of the most prestigious jobs in the administration, retired Vice Admiral and former Navy SEAL Robert S. Harward, turned down the post. Now, he could have a million reasons for doing this, wants to spend more time with his family. He could also want absolutely nothing to do with this turmoil that's already brewed in the Trump administration. Mark Lowenthal, as I said, former Assistant Director of Central Intelligence for Analysis and Production under the George W. Bush administration. Your view of all this?
Well, on the Harward thing, two things. Number one, I mean, it's a hard job to step into given what's going on. But what I'm hearing is that one of the issues was he wanted to choose his own staff. And he was told, no, you're going to have to take the staff we've begun to assemble. And one of the Washington rules is when you take a senior job, if you're not allowed to choose your own staff, don't take the job. And I think that apparently was one of the deal breakers for Harward, was he had worked very closely in the past with Secretary Mattis, Secretary of Defense. On the intelligence thing, I don't think we've ever seen an administration get off to this hostile a beginning with U.S. intelligence. We've had presidents in the past who have disliked us, who have fallen out of love with us. Richard Nixon continually referred to the CIA as, quote, a bunch of clowns. George W. Bush sort of fell out of love with us during the 2004 reelection campaign. But this level of hostility is unprecedented. And it's bad for the country is the main thing. It's just bad for our national security.
How much more serious is it as a problem going into a new administration as opposed to something that sours for one reason or another in the middle of an administration?
Well, it's a bad beginning. It's not the way to start a working relationship. There has to be some level of trust between the intelligence community and the president. They don't have to like each other. Many presidents at some point, you know, they'll get intelligence and they'll sort of give you this like, oh, why are you telling me this, really? Lyndon Johnson compared us to a cow's dirty tail messing up his bucket of milk. But there's no trust. There's no beginning of the relationship in here. There's the ingoing hostility and the assumption on the part of Trump that this is driven by partisan politics is just so completely off base. I mean, it's how he refers to most issues. but he doesn't understand the intelligence community. The intelligence community, 99.95% of the intelligence community is made up of career intelligence officers. There were very, very few political appointees. There were almost no political holdovers, as you would see at state and defense. They just don't exist. It's mostly career intelligence officers. It's very much like the military in that respect. And so to suggest that these are a bunch of either Obama holdovers or disgruntled Clintonistas holding up in Langley, Virginia, is just totally off base. But that's the way
Clintonistas.
That's the way he sees things.
Can I just say that for a second, Clintonistas?
Yes.
is this Bannon's doing? Is this something that he, you know, let's go in here and really clean house? And that part of what we're seeing here is his initiative to go at this really strongly.
Well, there's no way of knowing that. But you can't clean house at the CIA or at the Defense Intelligence Agency the way you can clean house in the cabinet departments, where there are literally hundreds of political jobs: secretary, deputy secretary, undersecretary, assistant secretary, deputy assistant secretaries are all political jobs. At the CIA, there's the director, the deputy, and maybe one or two other positions that will come from the outside. So who are you going to clean? At DIA, there are no political appointees, Defense Intelligence. At NSA, National Security Agency, there are no political appointees. So you can't clean house. These are professionals. And when a new administration comes in, their goal at the outset is to show how good they are. Mr. President, these are the things we can do for you. These are the things we can bring you. This is what we how we can keep you informed. They want to show off. And when you have to remember it, you know, he said in the weeks before the election, before the inaugural, he said, you know, I don't need to see them every day. They tell me the same stuff every day and it's boring. That's not a really good – he also didn't understand the nature of the briefings. He is getting briefings now, I'm told. It's not every day, which is fine. Not every president gets a briefing every day. Clinton famously did not get briefed every day. His briefings are rather short. They're oral. That's fine. But he doesn't have a tactile feel for what the intelligence community does. And I'm sure in the case of someone like Bannon, there's probably a certain amount of suspicion about what they do.
But he shut down this sort of opening discourse and dialogue, and that's going to be really, really damaging. Finally, before we go, this article that I have to ask about: U.S. spies are so wary of Trump they are withholding information from him. I mean, is that like spies around the world that won't call up Washington?
No. What that seems to be referring to is there's this I don't know this firsthand, so I'm reading back what you're reading. That apparently they're not sending forward a lot of some sensitive information to the White House. That's really not that unusual. In the president's daily brief, for example, there won't be tons of very sensitive information. It'll be more, these are the things that you need to know this morning, sir, and there may be some sourcing with that. So the system itself is running. They're apparently passing less stuff to the White House.
Mark, thanks so much. Great to talk to you.
Thanks for having me, John.
Mark Lowenthal, former Assistant Director of Central Intelligence for Analysis and Production, current president of the Intelligence and Security Academy. So what do you think about leaks? Do they help our democracy or do they hurt the administration, who is the subject of the leak?
Eric from Seattle. I think leaks do help if they are true and not simply subversive political falsehoods to manipulate people into some type of action. If they're true, though, more power to the people by information.
My name is Karen. I'm calling from North Virginia, Alexandria, actually. I can only see that they help. I don't understand the secrecy behind the stuff that's come out thus far, and I think that the public should know these things.
Let us know what you think. 877-8-MY-TAKE or head to the Takeaways Facebook page.
What is he going to do to protect civil liberties?
Would he support full financial aid for trade skills?
What is your stance on organized labor?
I would ask what steps he plans to take to see the needs of the everyday person he promised to support.
You plan on sticking to your guns.
So this is our project called 100 Days, 100 Questions. You can follow along using the hashtag on Twitter, 100 Days, 100 Qs. That's 100 Days, 100 Qs. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. How are we doing so far? We've got a lot of responses from people and a lot of questions to these very, very entertaining and unprecedented in many ways, 100 days.
Yeah, we sure have. We've been working our way through them, and we've got, boy, we're getting dozens and dozens of them. We try to winnow them down, John. And one of the questions we got from Amy Catania on Twitter, she asked us, what was the nature of Donald Trump's campaign's contacts with Russian intelligence? We've been talking about this all week. Of course, everybody's been listening on the show about congressional investigations into possible contacts with Russia. But I just wanted to update this really quickly because here's what we know so far. It has now become apparent that the FBI was investigating at least four Trump campaign aides. Those are Manafort, Roger Stone, Carter Page, and of course, Michael Flynn for possible contacts with Russia. Now, there was a little pearl of news embedded way deep down in that Donald Trump press conference yesterday. It took about four stabs of reporters asking him about these possible contacts. Donald Trump kept saying, I have no contact with Russia. I have no deals in Russia. I don't know about Russia. Until finally he was pinned down to say, can you emphatically say that there was no contact between anyone in your campaign? The president said, not that I know of. That's a different answer. Right. He said that the Russia nexus was a ruse and fake news. Members of Congress don't think that that's true. Republicans in the Senate and don't think that that's true. And that investigation, of course, is widening, John, and we will be talking about it some more.
In our 100 days, 100 questions, what do you mean when you say Iran is on notice? Todd, what can you say about the president's statements regarding nuclear proliferation in Iran, but also in North Korea? The president made some cryptic references to nuclear policy during yesterday's press conference, and everybody remembers that missile firing as the president was speaking earlier this week. Many of us are still in the dark about specific policies. What do you think?
Well, actually, it's interesting because the Iran on notice comment actually goes back to Mike Flynn when he was national security advisor. He said it on January 31st after Yemeni Houthis backed by Iran attacked a Saudi warship. Now, the statement at the time, John, seemed to be in context of the war in Yemen. And analysts have interpreted that statement to signal an intention from the Trump administration to increase support for Saudi Arabia's efforts in that Yemen proxy war. It's unclear exactly what that means. Some analysts also think it could mean an intention to step up covert efforts at regime change or undermining the Iranian government. Now, that gets really complicated. The Saudis will like that, and Israel may like it. But one problem, and one thing that shows just how complex the Middle East is, the Houthis are enemies of AQAP, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. There are no free moves here. So that gets very complicated. And of course, Mike Flynn is no longer national security advisor.
The project with the world and our partner, the PRI, are talking to Twitter to ask the president some of your questions about the new administration. 100 days, 100 questions. The hashtag is 100 days, 100 Qs. Todd, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
President Trump is in Charleston, South Carolina today to attend the rollout of a new plane from Boeing, the 787-10 Dreamliner.
This visit will give the president an opportunity to celebrate a huge milestone for thousands of workers at Boeing, America's number one exporter, and the millions of American workers involved in aerospace.
The Boeing plant employs about 7,500 people, a number that has grown steadily since Boeing opened up shop in the state in 2008. The company's decision to move some operations to South Carolina was the result of a strike of nearly 30,000 of its employees in the company's traditional home base in the Pacific Northwest over concerns of outsourcing, job security, and low pay, organized by a union, the International Association of Machinists. In South Carolina, though, Boeing found a very different, more southern approach to unions.
And finally, I am always proud to say we don't have unions in South Carolina because we don't need unions in South Carolina.
Former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, now Ambassador to the United Nations, speaking there in 2013. But that sentiment has been shared across the country in recent decades. Union membership currently stands at about 11% among American workers. Cut that in half from 23% in 1980. This week, both Boeing and the country's relationship to unions was put to the test when Boeing's South Carolina workers overwhelmingly rejected a move to unionize by a vote of 3-1. Jeff Hirsch is a law professor at UNC Chapel Hill who specializes in labor relations.
South Carolina, among other particularly southern states, they've made their pitch to companies as a low-cost, low-wage, non-union state and attracted, for instance, a lot of car manufacturers have moved into the South. And so they view it as a hit to that competitiveness if they start becoming known as a place where workers will actually vote to unionize. So for them, that was important that the union vote went against the union in this case.
How hard did the union try to work in South Carolina, and how many workers were at stake here?
The number of workers voting was about 3,000. The mechanics union, who was involved, had worked quite hard. I mean, in fact, they almost had an election in 2015, but pulled back, I believe, because it looked like they were going to lose. So this has been a multi-year effort, and you know, they had a lot at stake, both economically, because there was obviously a lot of workers involved, and frankly, the symbolism was quite large for them. It would have been a huge feather in their cap if, in response to Boeing opening up a plant in non-union South Carolina, as opposed to expanding the work in Washington State, which is what the union wanted, if they had actually managed to unionize that plant, it would have really been quite a big deal for them. So the loss definitely hurts, and frankly, the margin of loss, 74-26, was really quite large.
So would we say that the center of mass at the Boeing Corporation and the aerospace industry in the United States, at least on the commercial side, is moving to the South like the auto industry did a generation ago?
Yeah, I mean, it's not as obvious of a trend as it is in the automotive industry now. That said, to the extent that they're expanding, you would certainly expect them to look in the South at this point. I mean, whether in fact they're expanding is a different question. One of the issues I think that hung over the election in this case was the fact that Boeing had been engaging in talks or concerns about layoffs at that plant, which tends to drive down unionization interest.
In general, you know, the president, since he's taken office, has you know, made a very, very big deal about his jawboning corporations, his insisting that they stay in the United States, his insisting that they build manufacturing facilities here in the U.S. But he can't really take any credit for either the non-union vote or the jobs that are going to stay right here in South Carolina.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. It obviously predated – much of this predated even his campaign to a certain degree. And it's interesting. I mean, he sort of – Trump's approach and his influence on labor in the U.S. over the next few years is really an open question to me. I mean, as you said, a lot of his campaign focused on jobs, keeping jobs in the U.S., you know, against some of the foreign trade pacts, even some of the environmental measures, right? Those are all things that help actually give him quite a fairly large share of the union vote. That said, he's also not known for being so particularly supportive of labor protections. So there's a bit of a tension there in some of his positions, and we'll just have to see as he and his appointees start to, you know, actually do some more regulations.
Well, it'd reveal their policies, reveal the kinds of management that they support, and hold more of these photo ops. I think that's going to be a clear indication of what the style is.
No, absolutely. And, well, you know, we just saw an interesting switch on the Department of Labor nominee. We haven't seen nominees to the Federal Labor Board, but those will be quite important as well.
You know, that motivates one final question. The NLRB has been very active in Boeing and machinist union conflicts and disputes down over the years. What do you think the new Labor Secretary's resume is going to say to the workers at Boeing?
As far as the new Labor Secretary, I think actually for workers, even those who may lean more Democratic, he's actually probably a pretty good nominee. I actually know him a little bit. We were both at the NLRB at the same time, and I mean he's Republican clearly, and so he's probably going to lean more towards employer interests. But I don't think he's as reactionary or as far to the spectrum as some of the other nominees we saw, including Puzder.
Partisanship aside, collaboration can be expected here, given the personalities that you've seen?
I think, you know, if Acosta is confirmed, I do think he is more than willing to work with folks across the aisle. So I do think there is some opportunity there, you know, and of course, assuming the president's willing to go along with it as well. But I do think there's a chance of that.
Jeff Hirsch is a law professor at UNC Chapel Hill who specializes in labor relations.
I've come here to say one magic word to you. Cheeseburger.
What's the magic word?
Just say the magic word.
You didn't say the magic word.
Abracadabra.
Abracadabra. Abracadabra, Holmes.
What's the magic word?
Open sesame.
Matu, verata, nicto. Okay.
What is the magic word, Mr. Beckman? Please.
Well, the magic word this week is Great Wall. That's what we're going to talk about with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. So, Rafer, that is the big release. It's about the Great Wall, the real Great Wall. Donald Trump, if I'm not mistaken, even mentioned it yesterday at his news conference, although I don't think he mentioned this particular Great Wall. This was his Great Wall.
Right. Slightly different.
He called it a Great Wall.
Big, beautiful wall, I think.
He's sort of messing with the branding there, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, tell me a little bit about the Great Wall.
Well, this is a big deal for China. This is the most expensive U.S.-China production ever, $150 million. Matt Damon plays a European mercenary. He and his buddy go into China. They're looking for gunpowder. They're captured. They arrive at a fortress on top of this Great Wall, this big, beautiful wall. And it turns out that the Great Wall was built to keep out a kind of monster, a species, millions of monsters called the Tao Te. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. And they are attacking this Great Wall. And although Matt Damon is a mercenary, he feels a certain loyalty develops toward the Chinese, and he decides to stay with them and fight these creatures.
So the Tao Te are against the Chinese?
I think they're just against humanity in general.
Right,
yeah,
okay.
Not specifically the Chinese, but that happens to be where they are.
You remember how to do this?
Last time didn't go so good.
We were drunk.
How high?
10 yards. 6 hands to the right.
Turn around. No, do it this way. On my count.
Amigo.
1, 2, 3. Pull!
Now, what are they doing there? Climbing the wall?
They're not climbing the wall. That's actually Matt Damon showing off his archery skills to impress the Chinese, who don't believe that he and his primitive little bow can actually do anything. And so he does a little archery trick there in the hall during a banquet. This was filmed by Zhang Yimou, House of Flying Daggers, who was also the guy who did the 2008 Beijing Olympic ceremonies, kind of a national treasure in China, one of their best-known directors. So this is like a big point of national pride, I think, for China.
Is this a global cinematic business model in a sense? I mean, you've got Matt Damon, who I love.
Yep.
Willem Dafoe.
Yes,
that's right.
Yep.
Who could not love the Great Wall and the spectacular location where it's being shot and all of that? And then you get your monsters and
not the actual wall itself. I'm sorry to say, John. Well, sets.
Oh, it's not the actual.
They built another Great Wall.
A lesser wall.
Yes, that's right. A smaller wall.
A lesser wall. Well. And there's lots of martial arts.
You know, there isn't, actually. You might think there is because of the director. There isn't so much of that. There's a little bit of that elaborate kind of, Cirque du Soleil-style battles, a lot of slow-mo, Matrix-style action. There is that. This film has come under controversy, I think, also because of Matt Damon being the one white face in this, what looks like a Chinese movie. I'm not sure that's exactly whitewashing, technically. The role was always supposed to be for a European character, and Matt Damon has said that. You could call him a bit of a white savior here in this movie. I think the real problem here is that the movie just isn't very good, and I don't know where that $150 million went, because you're not really seeing it on screen. Like I say, that wall doesn't look that great. The aerial shots seem pretty clearly to be a computer model, like kind of an architectural model. And when you get in close to the sets, I guess things look a little better, but it's not a great story, and it doesn't hold up, I'm sorry to say.
Will the global collaboration make tons and tons of money?
I think it's already made $170 million in China. I'm sure it'll do okay abroad. I don't know if this will be the next great business model or not.
The lesser wall, we'll call it. Rafer Guzman weighs in on the movies every Friday. Film critic for Newsday. Thanks so much, Rafer. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, John. You too.
Melissa Locker, our culture reporter for Time, The Guardian, and The Takeaway, tells us that La La Land arrives at the Oscars already a legend, nominated for a record 11 Academy Awards, including Best Original Score. This may be a bummer of a year and a waste of dry cleaning and tuxedo rentals in a sea of strong contenders. Melissa argues that the work of a man who's part of a composing dynasty is not to be overlooked. A lesser-known member of the dynastic Newman family has yet to receive an Oscar after 14 nominations, but this could still be a tough year for the well-pedigreed genius, says Melissa.
Thomas Newman is nominated this year for Passengers. And whatever you thought about the movie, the score is fairly interesting.
He did American Beauty, which is almost all percussion.
Mm-hmm. He did Wall-E.
Which makes him a genius.
He did Shawshank Redemption.
He's got to win, but he won't. He won't.
He probably won't win. Yeah. But, I mean, his family also has a long history of not winning. Randy Newman, nominated 20 times and only won twice.
Still, I mean, Randy Newman is a songwriting legend. He's got 2 Oscars and 20 nominations. I mean, that must be so intimidating for... And then, of course, there's the dad, right? Alfred?
Alfred won 9 times, nominated 45 times. He's for films like The 7-Year Itch and All About Eve and How the West Was Won. I mean, these are all absolutely incredible movies, and he really just kind of kicked off the whole thing. Then Alfred's brother, Lionel, scored over 30 films. And then Alfred's other son, David, scored almost 100 films, including Galaxy Quest and Ice Age. It's very much a family affair. And his daughter, Maria, you can't overlook her. She was a musician and a composer as well. She's just not nominated, has not yet been nominated yet, or perhaps hasn't had the same opportunities, which is, you know, something that you see occasionally. Like this year, Micah Levi, who performs as Mikachu, she's the first woman in 20 years to get a nomination for her work on the film Jackie.
What's left to talk about here? I mean, Moonlight has an amazing theme and is going to win a lot of awards, but is music going to be one of them?
Everybody knows this year the score is most likely going to Justin Hurwitz for La La Land. And while you may not necessarily like the movie, it's hard to argue. Not only did he work on the score for, I think, 7 years, he wrote almost 2,000 piano demos to perfect the score. I think you do hear it, and people seem to really, really love La La Land, and you wouldn't have it without the music.
And Moonlight's going to win a lot of stuff, so It's not like the Academy is going to feel guilty about not voting for Moonlight on music.
Right. The one thing that I really love about the Moonlight score, though, is that it's fully classical, which I think is just so beautiful, especially because it would have been so easy for them, with the kind of the urban setting, for them to do some sort of like hip-hop theme or something, riff on like, I don't know, R&B. But instead it went full classical, and it's beautiful. And the dissonance between the two makes it even more resonant.
Moonlight is so counterintuitive. I mean, there are so many sort of competing, unexpected elements to that movie, including the music, that I think you're absolutely right. They did an amazing job there.
And then the other one we really can't overlook is Lion, the one about Dev Patel playing the orphan who makes his way to Australia and goes back to try and find his family. They found 2 neoclassical composers, Dustin O'Halloran and this guy named Hauschka, who works out of Germany. And either one of them probably could have scored the entire films themselves, but the director actually asked them to come together and work together, and they created this really complex score, which is sort of Indian-influenced and sort of Western-influenced, and I think they did a beautiful job.
Melissa Locker, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Melissa Locker, of course, is the culture reporter for Time, The Guardian, and The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering copy and print solutions for business materials printed in-store or ordered online, including business cards, presentations, large banners, and posters. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
Anyone who has a credit card has had a credit card balance, has had a maxed out credit card balance, has gotten some sort of junk mail offering to consolidate all your bills and get a lower payment. Well, this is the same kind of pitch, only it's for students.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm calling you from Student Loan Assistance Foundation. I'm calling you in regards to your student loan forgiveness. Just go ahead and give us a call back. Thank you very much and have a great day.
It's a real voicemail left for one of our producers here at The Takeaway. The ad promises you'll be able to reduce payments or totally get rid of your student loans. It's enticing for the roughly 40 million Americans who currently owe money on their student loans, totaling $1.2 trillion worth of debt right now. One problem, there is no such thing as the Obama student loan forgiveness program that a lot of these ads refer to. And these companies are using predatory tactics to lure consumers into consolidating their loans, tactics similarly used against other consumers, even scamming the people outright. Betsy Bayot is director of consumer outreach and compliance at American Student Assistance. She says these kinds of companies and offers are everywhere.
I've seen and heard advertising on Sirius Radio, other radio stations. I've seen it on some of the cable television channels. It pops up on Facebook and other social media sites. And again, those cold calls, even if you're on the Do Not Call list, they just come and come and come.
Now, debt consolidation, where you take a balance at one interest rate that may be left over from your time in college and, you know, turning it into a different balance at a different interest rate and therefore a different payment, may sound like a pretty good idea. But what are the limitations here and what is the overpromise?
Well, a lot of these companies actually promise loan forgiveness. And while there are multiple forgiveness programs available, especially under the federal loan programs, loan consolidation in and of itself isn't going to get you that forgiveness. The other big takeaway from consolidating your debt is that if you consolidate outside the federal program, you've just eliminated the possibility of utilizing any of the other federal benefits that are available. That includes income-driven repayment options, deferments, and those forgiveness programs that I talked about a second ago.
Now, income-driven repayment options are, does that mean if you have a job and you have income, you can defer payment or you can reduce your payment based on the income that you have from your job?
You got it. There's several different income-driven repayment options. All of them base your monthly payment on your income and your family size. You can stay on that payment plan for the life of the loan. Depending on which plan you're using, after 20 or 25 years under those plans, the remaining of the loan is forgiven. The plan caps the monthly payment at either 10 or 15% of your discretionary income, again, depending on which plan it is. What's even better is that if you happen to work in public service and utilize one of those income-driven repayment plans, the forgiveness happens after only 10 years.
And the business here really thrives on the growth of the, I guess some have called it the student debt bubble, and the demand and anxiety associated with people wanting to get out from underneath these debts as soon as they possibly can.
You're right. They thrive on fear. These companies are very similar to what we saw back during the mortgage issues back in the mid-2000s, 2008s. The similar companies, probably even sometimes the same companies, used the same advertising tactics and appeared to offer a lifeline to people that were struggling under mortgages that were too big for them to handle financially. We're seeing, again, the same side of fear tactics being applied to these vulnerable student loan borrowers.
Do you have a story of someone who really just got sunk by some junk mail that he or she opened?
I have many stories. The one that probably hit me the hardest is I had a consumer reach out to me. She had her PhD. She had been paying her student loans religiously for the last 15 years. She was down to her last $5,000 that she owed. And she got a cold call from one of these organizations promising loan forgiveness. She paid, I believe it was $699 up front. They told her that they were going to reduce her payment to $39 a month. She made that $39 a month payment to them for 2 years. She thought her loan, the remainder of her balance would be forgiven at that point. Turns out none of that money went to her student loan. They changed all the contact information so she wasn't receiving any mail or phone calls from her loan company. And by the time the dust settled, the company had disappeared with her money, her loan was in default, and she owed more than twice as much of the $5,000 that she had remaining.
Oh, that's
terrible. She bought the line. She bought the line. They sound, you know, they talk about the Obama forgiveness program. And that to me is a big tip that the company may not be on the up and up because there's no such thing as the Obama forgiveness program.
Is the Department of Education the enforcement mechanism here? I mean, are they the ones that we could expect to, you know, be the advocates here? And is there anything about the shifting administration that should cause concern?
Well, in the last few years, the Department of Education has done a lot of work just trying to outreach to student loan consumers to make sure that they realize that there's no need to pay for help with your student loans. My organization, the Center for Consumer Advocacy at American Student Assistance, we've done similar outreach, as have many other advocacy organizations in the industry. The various attorney general's office, Massachusetts in particular, California, they've also had some significant, robust communication campaigns. The only thing we can do, really, is communicate to consumers and make sure they realize that there are multiple free resources available for help with their student loans.
Betsy Mayotte, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Lots of information there from Betsy Mayotte, who's Director of Consumer Outreach and Compliance at American Student Assistance. The idea that complex dynamical systems evolved by acquiring competitive advantages over time was a wild and revolutionary idea back in the 1900s. The theories of English naturalist and geologist Charles Darwin were first introduced and had applications to businesses and free markets in the 1800s, explaining wealth disparities in the Gilded Age for those most inclined to believe in their own successes. But Darwin immediately caused a philosophical revolution with relevance to American religion, American race relations, an attempt to reconcile religion with science. The author of the book that changed America, How Darwin's Theory of Evolution Ignited a Nation, begins his story on New Year's Day, 1860, a little more than a year before the start of the Civil War, when a dinner party begins with luminaries like Henry David Thoreau first encountered a copy of Darwin's new book. What happens next, Randall Fuller says, was a wildfire of word of mouth, and the rest was history.
We tend to think of the 19th century as not being particularly rapid in the flow of information, but Darwin's book arrived in America in the early weeks of December 1859, and by middle of January 1860, there was an American edition, and people all over the East Coast were talking about it.
And that was partly because the first folks that got their hands on this book at a very particular wintry affair had quite a discussion, and that was what rippled out into the world.
That's right. There was a core group of American intellectuals, some of which listeners today would recognize, like Henry David Thoreau, perhaps Bronson Alcott, the father of Louisa May Alcott, but also lesser known people, but no less influential at the time, like the botanist Asa Gray, the child welfare reformer Charles Loring Brace. And all of them read the book, were excited by it for a variety of different reasons, and told their friends about it, and it did ripple out through the country very rapidly.
It was a book that changed people's thinking, and Henry David Thoreau is a great example. How did it change his thinking and put him on a different path?
Henry David Thoreau, we know today as the great transcendental hermit who lived on the one side of Walden Pond in Massachusetts. And as a transcendentalist, he tended to think that God permeated all of nature. But by the time he read Darwin's Origin of Species, he was becoming more scientific, and Darwin encouraged him to think more scientifically, more empirically. And nature became for him not the residence of God so much as a place of kind of constant new creation, as he calls it, a place of ongoing physical change. One of the things that we tend to forget is just how liberal or capacious religion was in the United States in the 19th century. What Thoreau is able to do is to wed a sense of the divine with the material or the physical, and he really doesn't have great difficulty doing that.
He doesn't see a contradiction.
He does not.
Yet the power of this book is also in the way that it permits people and encourages people to confront issues like slavery, which were at the peak of their brutality and violence in the 1800s.
That's right. I argue in the book that at least initially in the first year of its reception in the United States, Darwin's book was more important for what it had to say about racial ideology and slavery than what it had to say about religion or even the natural world. Particularly, Darwin's book is an attack on what was a dominant trend in science in the 19th century that posited that there were white people created in Europe, black people created separately in Africa, and that those black people were inferior to the white race.
How did that change of perspective play out in various American communities and certain individuals who were very powerful thinkers and politicians at the time?
Well, what it did was give scientific justification for the abolitionist cause. What Darwin's argument was is that all of these races actually derived from the same common ancestor. And in many ways, that's the same argument that theologians argued, right? With Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden are the originary parents of the human race. So Darwin's argument fused these powerful trends in religious and abolitionist thought and really galvanized especially the northeastern part of the United States.
This book had a particular influence on John Brown. What was it?
Well, the influence is in the other way. John Brown was executed for his famous raid on Harper's Ferry, in which he hoped to foment a slave rebellion. That execution occurred just about the same time that Darwin's book arrived on these shores. And so the discussion about slave uprising coupled with a book that could be construed as pro-abolition made for a very potent force.
What would Darwin have said if you had confronted him at the time he was alive with this idea of, what are you talking about? We're monkeys? Which was very much a part of the controversy in the United States in the 20th century.
That's right. Darwin actually had a great sense of humor about that. And later, in the late 1860s, he writes a book called Descent of Man, which is about his evolutionary theory applied to people. But an American friend of his visited and reports that one of Darwin's favorite letters was from an outraged Connecticut minister who had said, I know who your ancestor is, and it has to be an ape.
thinking he was insulting Darwin.
Yes, and Darwin, he had a charming modesty about him, and he took this as kind of an amusing letter that unwittingly confirmed what he was getting at in the first place.
Randall Fuller is the author of The Book That Changed America, How Darwin's Theory of Evolution Ignited a Nation. Randall, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. For the week, in fact, all you primates out there. On Monday, spotlight on the highest office in the land. If you're having difficulty figuring out who this president is, on our President's Day, we're going to have a special on executive power. Has your view of presidential power changed over time or since the inauguration?
This is Ann Person from Seattle, Washington. I think national security has become a cheap excuse for expanding presidential power. Especially since 9/11, Americans seem to be willing to circumvent the normal legislative processes toward the dubious end of security. As a patriot and someone who firmly believes in our Constitution and the American dream, it hurts my heart.
Well, there have been a lot of confrontations between executive power and the Constitution. It's a narrative that goes way back in history. We're going to talk all about it on the Hour Show on Monday. 877-8-MY-TAKE. We'd love you to contribute. Takeaway's Facebook page is also open for us. If you can't find us on the dial, listen to our special episodes by subscribing to the Takeaway podcast. Find us on iTunes. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org. And by Staples, offering copy and print solutions for business materials printed in-store or ordered online, including business cards, presentations, large banners, and posters. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
PRI, Public Radio International.